Hey-yo, it's WTC one more time on the air and in your ear. We Talk Comics is back with episode number 31, and welcome us as we enter the Court of Jowls. And I'm going to open up this week, throw out to my buddy Brett. Brett's going to introduce himself by telling us Transformers or G.I. Joe.
Oh, well, for me, that one's super easy. It's always G.I. Joe. I'm such a big fan of Yo, Joe!
And, of course, we got Keith with us. Which one, Keith?
G.I. Joe. No competition.
No competition?
He's a real American hero.
There you go. Chris, what are your thoughts?
I like G.I. Joe, too. But just to, for the sake of difference, I'm going to go with the Headmasters.
Can I change to Mask?
Mask? No, you can't. I'm going...
Hey.
Who are the visionaries?
Transformers.
Oh. Wow. All right. Well, I'm telling you Transformers because they're machines that turn into they're robots. Duh. Plus, they got that movie, and that movie had that song. We got the touch.
Are they machines that turn into
we
robots?
We got the
I thought
power.
They were robots that turned into machines.
What's that?
I thought they were robots that turned into machines. You're telling me they're machines that turned into robots.
I think the point is they're more than meets the eye.
They are more than meets the eye, and we are so dropping that song into the end of this podcast. But that's all right. So it is, we're entering the Court of Jowls. Of course, the Court of Owls, the crossover event, first crossover event from DC is the big event of the week, and we will be getting into that. But since we have our legendary award-winning, I believe he's the three-time winner of the coveted Silver Sow Award, we have the weekly news with Cub Reporter K.
Well, this week in news, I have used up all the news. We recorded late last week, and all of the C2E2 announcements went into the episode. So the last one that was on that list, there is a ongoing Gambit series being launched in the late summer by James Asmus, who had written Generation Hope, with art by Clay Mann. The return of Gambit to the X-Universe. Who's excited?
Never, the character never jived for me.
I didn't know he was gone.
Who did? Lame.
And we're getting just a teaser that, as well as the Free Comic Book Day DC book, giving us the next chapter for Pandora, there is rumor to also be a tease for something that will come up in 2013 called the Trinity War.
From DC.
DC's Trinity.
Everybody remember the, anybody remember the Trinity miniseries in the, I believe early 90s? Was it Dark Stars, Green Lantern, and, Manhunters? Was that it?
So the crossover was DC Universe Trinity, Green Lantern, Legion 93, and Dark Stars. Two issues of each of those three books, and then two issues of Trinity on either end.
Alright, pretty damn good miniseries if I remember correctly. That's all I'm saying. And the Trinity stuff. I've had the trade paperback of that Trinity, the Superman one, forever. Never bothered reading it yet, so maybe I'll get to it. Always looked good, just never had the time yet. I'm kind of like Keith, they got a pile.
Did you guys hear that Mobius died?
did you hear that Keith hates the French? Except for poutine?
French is...
Everybody loves poutine.
Poutine is French-Canadian. It's not really the same thing.
It's not really the same thing. Well, no, but it's not any better.
Sure, they're actually called French fries. It refers to a narrow cutting. Not that they're French at all.
Well, yes, it's French, called Julian, the style of cutting.
Yeah.
Yeah. I prefer freedom fries, personally, but hey, who doesn't? So now let's move on.
Yeah, that's pretty lame, actually.
No kidding. All right, we're going to move on here. What we got this episode, for the meat of this episode, until we get into our reviews and talking Court of Owls and all that good stuff, what we got going on here is kind of last week we had Paul O'Connor, Lombox Graveyards, his fantastic blog, and he came on. He's the brand director for Appy Entertainment. He came on and he told us all, kind of gave us some insight into his views, former freelance writer, and kind of his views on where comics may be going or should be going, and about a billion and one subjects. And he talked to Keith and Chris for about 75 minutes, somewhere there in that range, and it was awesome. But the four of us kind of, we threw that in as the end interview. The four of us didn't get a chance really to react on it, especially as a group. Brett unfortunately wasn't with us last week, and we're glad of him back this week. Unfortunately, Keith is still here. But anyways, no, we're going to move on here. What we're going to do is we're going to kind of react to some of the subjects that we got from Paul, and thank you once again. If you guys didn't listen to it, it's if you're interested in the future comics, it's one of the best 75 minutes you're ever going to listen to in your entire life. So what we're going to do here is I'm going to move on to some subjects coming out of it. So I'm going to go on to something. I'm going to open up with something that kind of hit me this week because I was at work, and I listen to the local sports radio station while I'm doing it. And the local sports radio station largely targets adult males 25 to 45, kind of in that range, 25 to 44 in that range. And is very popular, not so much in the urban markets here in where we are, but so much kind of in the rural areas with the farming in folks and stuff like that is actually where they're most successful. And they had a commercial for AVX, a radio commercial for Avengers versus X-Men. So I kind of want to talk to you guys about that, coming off of some of what Paul was talking about of marketing and trying to bring people in. So it was a commercial. It mentioned that Avengers are taking place against X-Men. And then it went through and said after that and kind of laid out the plot a little bit. Then it went through and listed featuring Captain America, Thor, Wolverine, Cyclops, and basically went through and listed off the cast. And I thought that was pretty interesting. I've certainly never heard that before. And also interesting, it was on a sports radio station. Just all of it caught me off guard. So I want to get some feedback from anybody if they want to kind of signal in. Anybody have anything to say on that? And let me know if they have any thoughts on the fact that... Keith, go ahead.
Well, I think it's interesting the demographic they're hitting. It's the right one to target this kind of messaging. Now, comics has advertised in the past. It's just been a long time. And it was when it was exactly the right market. There were advertisements for the G.I. Joe comic book during the G.I. Joe cartoon, for example, in the 1980s. There were ads for DC's New 52 in movie theaters, amongst other places. The problem with marketing these days is comic books are actually not available everywhere like they were 20 years ago, because they're not carried in newsstands like they used to be. There are only a couple of thousand comic stores in North America, so most of the people hearing your ad are not going to be anywhere near one. Digital comics changes that, because with digital comics, everyone's near a comic store. Everyone with a high-speed internet connection or a smartphone is near a comic store all of a sudden. And maybe this is an opportunity to get back into that. I'm wondering, Mo, where they directed you to buy the comic in that ad.
And you know what? As a one-time spot that I heard, I can't recall where they said. That's unfortunate. I wish I had caught that. But I'm afraid, Keith, I can't tell you.
I would
be
surprised.
The call to action failed.
Yeah, they're missing it. I mean, the call to action, my guess would have been Marvel.com, which can also, it will link you to where comic stores are. So that'll be my guess. But yeah, that call to action at the end of the ad, because I mean, certainly it caught your attention, and it does sound like a compelling, storyline. I mean, I tell people the Avengers versus X-Men, and they automatically get what that means, because those characters are pretty well known now since the X-Men. And now,
well, I have to tell you, when I heard it, my immediate thought is, if they're doing, what is it, how many, 250,000 approximately, that was the sales of the Avengers of AVX1, and, you know, X-Men number one 20 years ago is doing, you know, 1.5 million, that's who they're targeting. That's especially if they're going after the 25 to 44 demographic that is the base of that group is people that probably once were reading but have left, and they're trying to bring them back by saying, "Hey, something big is happening over here. Come in." And that's my guess. Any thoughts on that, Keith?
Well, I think this is the same kind of thing New 52 tried, and you know there's lots of yammer about, well, they didn't bring in new readers, etc. But that was never the intention of New 52. New 52's intention was to get back lapsed readers. New readers would be great, but DeDito always said that it was they wanted the 90s guys back because there were so many of them. And Marvel can do the same. Marvel has finally got me back interested with Schism and what they're doing with that philosophical difference between Wolverine and Cyclops. But it's something that you can get your teeth into right away when you grab the first issue of AVX.
And it is, you know what, I think it is a good idea. So what about, I want to get your thoughts, everybody's thoughts on, is it possible Compost could advertise on television? Or is it just not financially viable? Because the idea is that if they were able to increase their sales to the point where they're doing 1.52 million or more, theoretically, with product placement and even advertisements, even digitally, there's ways you can advertise and do these things. It used to be comic books were making money. I mean, before comic books raised the prices eventually to the point where the money was being made from the sale of the issues. But there was a point in time when comic books were largely making their income from ads, and they've kind of lost that, and that's one of the reasons I have issue with the price of it going up so high, and then the price of the trade paperbacks also being, often if I was to collect a 4-issue miniseries, it's actually more expensive to get the trade paperback than to collect them 4 individually. Which confused me. So I'm kind of wondering, could we see it that way? Is it financially, do you think, is there any chance that it's viable for us to see them advertise on television and other markets more, or other mediums more regularly? Brett, what do you think?
I just don't think it's feasible to do TV ads on a regular basis for comic books. I mean, it's really expensive to do TV ads, and it's not just because of the actual creation of the ads. I mean, the creation of the ads, in the case of Marvel, they could probably whip up an animated spot relatively easily. But the problem is that they have to buy the time, and they have to decide what time they're going to buy, how much they're going to buy for, even that radio spot. It would be interesting to know, like, what time it played, how much time they actually bought. Like, is it only going to play once in a day? Is it going to play, like, 4 times an hour or something like that? There's just so many variables that go into it that I just don't see that you could feasibly do it, given their sales.
Chris, what do you think?
Well, I remember back in the day when X-Factor launched with the original X-Men, and they had television ads. And I remember thinking how lame it was that, you have this wonderful medium of comic books, and it doesn't translate well to television or radio, for that matter. It's a visual medium that doesn't move. I really don't think television or radio is the way to go. But that said, I think it's more important the market they're focusing on. They're not advertising to the G.I. Joe fan or the younger market. They're just trying to get readers back, and I think that's a death nail to the industry.
Keith, your thoughts?
Well, I think as far as the buy goes, it has to be something as broad as New 52 or AVX, because it has the tie-in books. The reality on AVX is it shipped about 200,000 copies at $4 a copy. Take half of that or more for, and once you have the discount to the dealers, you're talking about $300,000 to $400,000. That doesn't get you very far in a national campaign. Now the show you were listening to, Mo, you said it was a sports radio. Was that a syndicated show or was it a local show?
No, it was local. It was a local show.
Okay.
It was a local show. It was somewhere between 1 and 3 o'clock, in the afternoon. And I only heard it one time, and I listened to this station fairly regularly. So, I mean, they're not, certainly not flooding the market, but, my belief is if they're going after the 25 to 44 year olds, what they're looking for is like Chris said, they're trying to bring back those people that were the 1.5 million who purchased X-Men number one in 1991, 1992, in that range, whenever that came out. So I would guess they're trying to bring those people back, but I don't know that it doesn't, I don't know that it doesn't translate like Chris thinks, because it's not about how good it looks. It's about creating brand awareness. And Brett talks about how expensive it is. Well, how expensive is it if you're going to advertise on Spike TV, which isn't even the top 25 television cable stations? On the other hand, its core demographic is, again, that same 18 to 34, 25 to 44-year-old. That's who Spike TV goes after. I can't imagine the advertising with them is fantastically expensive.
I think it's still a prohibitive number for the most part for, and again, it's the volume of buys that you would have to get. To put one ad on the air at midnight is not that expensive. To put four ads on the air during prime time is expensive.
Okay, you know? But if we're talking about, like Keith says, if they're going to sell this and you're earning $400,000, but what if it gives a bump across the board to all your product? What if all of a sudden you're able to charge more for advertising? What if all of a sudden you're able to put in product placement? What if all of a sudden it creates it creates a property like your characters that you're going to license out for toys, license out for video games, license out for movies? All of a sudden they have extra chance to earn income across the board. I mean, you can't just look at it and look at the one little thing like, oh, well, you're not going to make enough profit by selling AVX in order to make this worthwhile.
I'm not debating the uses of advertising. If it works for them, then absolutely, the advertising is totally worth it. My thought is that based on the cost, it might be worth it for AVX. Is it going to be worth it for a smaller title? I don't believe so, just based on cost.
What about just for the not so much that smaller title, as you mentioned, but for the company as a whole, and like you say, for the brand awareness as a whole? I mean, television works on every – it's the most powerful way to reach a broad market still is through television, right, at this point. But, I mean, television works for everything else, from clothing to food to movies, entertainment. So, I mean, nobody's really done it. I mean, I'm not sure it would succeed. But I'm not so sure that we shouldn't have somebody kind of take the chance either. Chris, what do you think?
What you're saying has a lot of merit, but at the same time, I have to look. AVX is not that book. The merchandising for this book is limited, to say the least. It's two big character groups. If they were launching a brand new title like this, I would agree with you 100%. As it is, they are just advertising the comic book, not the brand.
Okay. Well, let me tell you one of the reasons why I think that AVX is a great book to do this with, and I'll get you guys' thoughts on this. Because it contains, number one, it contains pretty much every major character that people care about within the Marvel Universe. But number two, it's a book that parents can – it's not a book like some of the books that we pick up that I would have trouble if I had a young child giving it to and feel uncomfortable with the subject matter. The level of violence or anything like that you're seeing in AVX also, I think parents would be uncomfortable giving it to their children or reading with their children or reading themselves. Whereas I think some books they've kind of crossed that line. Keith, your thoughts on that?
Well, it's funny. Yesterday on Twitter, someone was talking about AVX issue 2, and they were quite sarcastically saying, it's a great book if you still enjoy smashing two action figures together when they fight. And I thought, that is the perfect sales pitch, though. Introduce a new person. You know, that audience that used to say that, you know, you bought Justice League because you got all your favorite characters in one book for one price. You know, the 12-year-old, the 14-year-old that has that discussion of, could Superman beat up the Hulk? This is the book for him. Give him this book now.
That's true. But that is something else I want to get into that does bring up something else I say that Paul talked about. And he seemed to be – I mean, certainly the books that he would have written for Malibu, you know, X-Mutants and books like this, wouldn't have content that I think anybody would be uncomfortable with giving a child with. And he seemed to be of the mindset that – because the fan base right now is more accepting of violent product, that's what they're willing to do without any thought that is actually turning away a chance to introduce that product to new people. I think one of the books we're going to review this week, Nightwing, was rated T and contained one of the most violent and graphic decapitations you could ever probably imagine, and it's not even Team Plus. And I do think that they have kind of blown it with this. That's one of my issues with the 52. And I think it continues to be the trouble properly setting the books for a context that they feel welcome in people's households now is something I think that they've kind of missed. Anybody have any thoughts on that and on Paul's opinion there? Brett, go ahead.
I think my biggest problem with it is that it really does seem like they're going to wind up to a certain degree cutting their nose off to spite their face. It just seems to me that they're working really hard at getting these books that do fit the current, you know, times. But the problem is that I do think there is a barrier for the younger audience to come in on these books, because now, admittedly, when I was like 16 years old, it's that idea of, sure, a lot of violence, a decapitation or two, and I'm interested. But, you know, up to that point, I think it's a really hard chunk to break in when all the books are so adult. And I just think that, you know, it's going to be difficult to see as we move along. I just feel like there's going to be a little bit of an age gap where people just aren't going to be, you know, joining up with comic books quite as readily as they used to.
Yeah, and it's not only difficult for the 10-year-old maybe to accept it, it's also, I think, difficult for the parent to be willing to give it to them.
Yeah, you know, absolutely.
If you read it and go, "Oh, man, Nightwing was great, but I can't give it to my son," that's a fail.
No, I mean, I certainly can't give it to my son,
he's a little young.
He's way too young.
Even if he was a little older, you wouldn't feel comfortable. I know you wouldn't.
No, exactly.
Yeah. Chris, what are your thoughts there?
When I started collecting comics, it was for all the reasons you guys are talking about. I wanted that. That's what attracts kids. The sex, the violence, the fact that's a little bit naughty. Of course, I mean, I'm a bad one to ask because I think we should give Boys to The Boys by Garth Ennis to all kids everywhere.
and that's why you're not welcome in my house.
Well, at least you have to open any present he brings for your son before you hand it to him, that's for sure.
But, I mean, I think the third or fourth book I actually put in my first comic book file was Elektra the Assassin.
Yeah, and how old were you, 13?
12.
12, okay. What if you're 8?
I'm kind of good with it.
Chris, oh my God. Okay.
I love it. I gotta say, I loved my first mature reader's comic book. I felt like I was getting away with something. I was, 16 or 17 reading, The Unknown Soldier, by Chris Priest.
You're 16 or 17 reading The Unknown Soldier. I think that's a little bit different than you being 10-year-old and every single book contains this level of violence. And like I say, if parents aren't, it's not even so much about what the kids like, it's about what it's also partially what the parents feel comfortable with. Brett, what do you think on that?
Well, the problem is that when we were 16 and 17 or even like 14 years old, those books said mature readers on them. Those books were specifically, like when we looked at those books just from the cover, we were like, I know this is a naughty book. Whereas nowadays, when you look at a Nightwing and it says T on the cover, you don't know that it's going to have something like that in it. You know, it's just not something that, like, I liked going into for the mature readers books, because yes, I knew that I was going to get something that I probably was too young to get. You know, in this case though, they're just handing it out to those people that are too young, flat off the bat.
Yeah.
No, I need to respond to that because, I mean, I remember back in the day though, I mean, I was even hiding G.I. Joe from my parents because it was an army thing and my mother would object. There's violence there. My point being, I mean, my views on censorship and the mature label, that aside, I'm not willing to discuss that tonight. I'm just saying that they have to be a little bit naughty for it to attract the audience. If they sometimes cross a line. I don't want to live in a world where kids are Disney-fied into these homophobic pussies. I hate that.
Okay.
I think comics should address all.
And, Chris, nobody's saying comics shouldn't address all. But let me tell you something. You don't want to live in the world where they're Disney-fied homophobic pussies. I don't want to live in a world where they're desensitized to violence to the point where we're going to see them become either. Nobody is calling for censorship. What they're calling for, though, is that a story – does a book like Nightwing need to have a decapitation in order to be an effective book? It doesn't. It doesn't need that. And now don't get me wrong. Does a book in Vertigo need that to have an effective book? Perhaps because it's marketed properly for a different audience. And that's the point where you're missing here, Chris. And nobody's saying that there should be censorship or comics shouldn't be able to be as violent or do whatever as they want. But, I mean, God damn it. We're talking about superhero books here. You know, superhero books that are supposed to be available for all ages. And there is a big difference between the vast majority of books we're seeing nowadays and G.I. Joe. Keith, what do you think?
Well, I'm gonna parse it slightly differently than you did, Mokes. I think I absolutely have no problem with Nightwing having that kind of level of violence in it. But I'm going to go back to your earlier point that if it's going to have that level of violence, the information needs to be provided to the parent that that's what's in it. And,
yes,
you know, like we did have, and I have no problem with that level of violence. We'll get to the reviews later, but I quite enjoyed that book. And I do look for a more mature book. I mean, as I joked last week's episode, I want the writer to have the freedom to have nudity or foul language or violence that's appropriate to the story and not be restricted in that. And that's what I'm finding. I'm finding both sides. But I'm finding both sides on New 52, where on the one end, I don't feel there's a whole lot accessible for the 12 to 16 audience. And at the top level, it doesn't feel like they're a full-on mature reader's book either. And I think they just need to pick a side.
Yeah, well, you know what? Like I say, I had an issue last week with how there was a mature reader book with very little foul language and then a teen-plus book with copious amounts of foul language over from Image, because it's not so much that you need to censor it, but if you do put out that book, you need to market it correctly. That's one thing, but you're right, Keith. But I'll mention also that if you're doing a superhero book, if you're doing a Batman book and it's part of a crossover and it is designed for adults, then it shouldn't be part of that crossover.
Well, that debate, that was a discussion 25 years ago though, when you know, Millennium had crossovers into Swamp Thing, and you know, and so did Crisis. Those were it was mature readers' books, and they were crossing over into a non-mature readers' storyline. And I couldn't purchase Spectre or Swamp Thing that crossed over with those books, even though I was buying the rest of the stuff in the line. Mm-hmm. So I mean, this isn't a new thing.
This isn't a new thing, though.
You were just going to the wrong stores.
Yes, there was a store that that my co-hosts went to that shall remain nameless, that famously was accused of selling comic books to underage children and raised a lot of money to help in their legal defense. I believe all of my co-hosts bought mature readers comics while they were underage from that store.
Yeah, that store's no longer around though, so you can't. I don't think it hurts to mention them. But.
Well, I think it's still called the Comic Legends Legal Defense Fund, though. Isn't it?
That's probably true.
I think so. And yes, they absolutely were. Just yes. Fantastic.
Playboys for everyone.
Chris, of course, got his moral guidelines from
Screw
those store owners.
Dr. Seuss, give him Playboy. Put some balls on them. Put some hair in the chest right from the beginning.
Here's an Archie and here's a cherry pop tart.
You make the decision.
You know what? That's not a bad combo.
Oh, wow. All right. Let's move on to one of the other subjects that we got from the fine topic last week. I'm of the opinion that indie comics will always exist. There's no indie television shows really, but there is indie movies, and there is indie music, and there will always be indie comics, and that's because they're so bloody cheap to produce. Now, there seemed to be a kind of a feeling that there was a pall or a black cloud or hanging over the entire comic book industry at the end of that conversation last week. Do you guys think that indie books will always exist? My contention is simply because it's cheap to do. Anybody can do it. Brett.
Well, for one thing, I actually do believe that indie television does exist. A lot of it has just moved on to the internet. The internet has allowed us to kind of get independent television out there. Like the Guild, you know, look at Felicia Day and what she's done with that. I mean, really, you don't get much more independent than that. But I do believe that indie comics will exist, because there's always going to be somebody who wants to do comic books. And there's always going to be, you know, people that they're going to find to help them out with it. You know, it's like Comic Stripe. They're going to do it. And as long as they keep going, then whether they put it out on print, whether they put it out digitally, it doesn't matter. But you need to have some sort of feeder system to get to the big times anyways. And independent comic books are still amongst the best ways of doing that.
Keith, your thoughts?
Well, I think that's one of the opportunities that independent comics have right now is what independent musicians had 10 years ago. We were talking with Paul about how Marvel and DC, they're so married to the comic shop model, and this isn't an anti-comic shop argument, of course, but they're so tied to the print pipeline that everything that they're doing digital has to then wrap around and make sense within that print model staying around. An independent creator or a small publisher doesn't have to do that. You can have someone like Slave Labor, who just said, we're not going to print anything anymore. It's not worth it. Because you can come to our website and buy it for 99 cents, and that's, why don't you do that? And then the ones that are popular, we'll collect them up and sell them to the comic shops. And there was no, you know, the comic shops didn't lose sleep over Slave Labor not printing comics anymore. And so the independents have that kind of flexibility. The small press have that kind of flexibility. And they can change the model. Comic Stripe, for example, as Brett brought up, they started with small distribution, keeping it cheap, printing 500 or 1,000 copies and figuring it out. They've just announced that they will be distributing through Diamond coming up. They've just signed their agreement. So they're using the opposite direction, but they won't be giving up their direct with retailers relationships to do that deal with Diamond, though. So they can change the model really fast. They can look at what's going on graphically. They can move much more nimbly than the large companies can. This is a great opportunity for them to get their product in front of people.
Okay. Now, independents are one of the topics you guys talked about was how in the 70s when the multiplex movies came about, how there'd be an opportunity for indie movies and foreign movies and all these things. And now instead, if there's 14 screens, you know, more than half of them are playing the most popular movie of the week. And my contention for that was that that's probably because those movies were, at the end, the better movies. The best product at the end will win out. If on iTunes, you see Superman and the Batman and the Wonder Woman, and the Spider-Man instead of the independent books, it's because if you take 100 comic books from the independents, you take 100 comic books from the major publishers, and you put them to people in the hands of people who have never read a comic book in their lives, at the end of the day, most of the time, they will still say that the major publishers' books are better because the quality is better. They're able to find the best artists. They're able to find the best writers. Their printing quality is better, or even just the coloring quality is better. And so that's one of the opinions why I think that you know, I mean, you're going to talk about there being a lot of Superman and Batman there. That is one of it. It's there because it's good, as a general rule. Does anybody disagree with that?
Yes. Who wants to go first and disagree? Brett, go ahead.
Okay. Well, I mean, I do disagree because, and it's the same case in the case of Marvel. I mean, with AVX, they have the money to advertise. Comic Strip does not have the money to advertise. You know, when it comes down to an independent movie, The Hunger Games has tons of money to put into advertising, whereas the local independent movie does not have tons of money to put into advertising. Advertising is what is going to get you onto 14 screens in the Googleplex. And it's the same thing in comic books. You know, if you can afford to advertise more, if you can afford to put this kind of product out, you know, the truth is that Marvel, the vast majority of Marvel and DC are crap, but they continue to put it out anyways. I mean, no independent company could live on that model of just continuously flooding the market with crap, because they would eventually be like, wait a minute, we're losing money hand over fist. You know, I mean, we're going to go to business, you know, but here's Marvel and DC and they can afford to put out 52 titles, you know, 30 of which are garbage.
And I think there are good movies that do well. There are good movies that do poorly. There are bad movies that do well and there are bad movies that do poorly. If there was a perfect math for you spend this much money and you make this much money, then John Carter would have done fabulously well. But it's just not the reality. There are, I can't stand the Transformers movies, but they are mass popular. And that's why they do well in the theater. There is just a level in comics, like in everything else, that the recognizability is sometimes more important than the quality. Not necessarily over the long term, but if you look at DC sales right now, Batman, number two book, which is great. Batman and Robin is like number five or six, which is great, because I love those two books, and from my opinion, those are the best two books. But all four of the Batman titles are in the top 10 for DC. And not all four of those titles belong in the top 10, but people know who Batman is. That's why they're there. So I think its recognizability has much more impact than the quality of the book in this kind of case.
See, and that's the thing. Recognizability does certainly play a portion. At the end of the day, though, if the Batman is not one of the top 10 best books out there, but it is one of the top 50 or top 100, that's enough to keep it up there because it's Batman. But if it was the 500th best book, it still wouldn't be enough to keep it up there. I mean, my thing is, if you take 100, like I said, if you take 100 comic books and put that they're independent, you take 100 that are major publisher and you put them in the hands of people who never read, at the end of the day, they're going to come back, I'm convinced, and say that these are better. Same thing in movies. If you took 100 independent films and you took, or foreign films, and you took 100 major produced films, put them in the hands of people who never seen movies, I'm convinced at the end of the day, they're going to come back and say those ones are better. At the end of the day, it doesn't mean that you're always going to win, and it doesn't mean that there isn't gems among the small press or among the independent films, and it doesn't mean that you're always going to have a great movie just because it has a big budget. But I mean, if you're giving fans what they want, it's because what has won out, it's not just advertising. Partially, it is quality. And it is being comfortable with knowing what you're going to get. At the end of the day, people don't want a lot of risks, and that's one of the things about people. People won't even spend 99 cents on an app because they don't want to take a risk. They'll spend no money and try it, and then after they like it, they'll pay for extra features. Same thing with movies and same thing with comic books.
I think you got around to it there at the end, Mo, that it is that element of risk, and that's what hits the mass market. That's what the mass audience likes, is knowing exactly what it's going to be. I was complaining today, you know, someone was making a comment about, you know, why did they make bad movies? I'm like, well, why do I hear Transformers 1 and 2 were awful? If I don't like Transformers 3, there's no way I'm going to go see 4. Like, why do I hear that? Why did you see 2 and 3? Why did you give them your money if you hated the first one? But you know exactly what it's going to be. Maybe it'll be 10% better than what you saw last time. But you know precisely what you're getting from that experience. And that's what Batman... That's one of the things with Batman, that you know exactly what you're getting. You're getting a Batman book.
And when you get one, and when you get the Dark Knight in one time and people consider it brilliant, almost everybody enjoys it with that budget. I mean, it builds up a lot of trust for the product. You know, like I say, I love comics driving. Nobody supports independent comic books more than me. I know there's gems out there, but I also know just because it's independent doesn't mean it's necessarily good. Because sometimes they just aren't. And the same thing, like sometimes a big published book or a big movie isn't either. Now, as we're talking about independent books and we're talking about the future and where they're going to, how about this? Because Paul mentioned how we're going to see a lot of Superman and Batman. That seems to be the general consensus here from you guys as well. So how about we talk a little bit about, what can the independent books do to be ahead of the curve in this digital marketplace? What can they do? I mean, have we already seen it when Keith talked about the slave labor? Go ahead, Keith.
I think one of the challenges that independents have is we haven't gotten to that standalone player yet, the iTunes type player that everyone can get onto, because Comixology is still a proprietary reader. You still have to sell through them to use that format, and that's problematic. Right now, I mean, Graphically is trying to be the second, but really they're moving in the books. And we've got Kindle, we've got, 20 different formats, but none of them are really helpful to the small players. In music, I often use the iTunes model, but in music, if you're a small player, you can put an MP3 on your website, and I can play that on my iTunes player. If you're a small comic book producer, and you put 4-page preview on your website, you're stuck with CBZ, which is generally an illegal format, or PDF, which I don't really care for as a format because it's not really designed for what you want to use it for. Or JPEGs. You don't have a lot of options that are compatible with other comics that you're buying legally.
Chris, you had some thoughts there.
Yeah, actually, that was the one thing about our conversation with Paul that really resonated with me after and made me feel good, is I really think we have a huge, independent publishers have a huge, huge opportunity here. If a publisher were to develop a app where they could market to me and comic book fans a 99-cent book, or books, plural, because I'm not downloading an app that only has one book, and market digitally exclusive, lower the price point, and do everything that Marvel isn't doing. Reinvent the market for the independent. I'd love an app that offered me comic books for 99 cents. I don't care if they're not Batman and Superman. I'd love to see an independent app that actually presents material to me that I hadn't seen before. I really think this is a huge opportunity for the independents.
Yeah, you know what? I have to say, I think so too, because I think it's an opportunity for independents largely because I look at the major publishers and I think more than almost any other medium, the major players in the comic book industry seem to me hesitant to conform to trends and changes in technology. And so, I mean, if the small press are ahead of the game on that, you think they'd have a shot. Brett, what do you think?
Well, I completely agree. I mean, as Paul mentioned, the concept of Marvel and DC being wedded to the concept of, storefronts. And I think that as we see the digital or like the independent companies, I mean, they really do have that opportunity. And I hope for their sake that they can make it work. But I'm also going to go back to something that you said earlier and this idea of people and their, lack of willingness to take a chance. And so I am concerned that kind of same philosophy would carry over, even if they create something really good, that because it's not Superman and Batman, they just won't take a chance on another app, even if it is a lot better.
Better than Comixology, you mean?
Well, better than Comixology. Nothing's better. The only thing
nothing's not going to confuse. Nothing
podcasts,
is,
right?
No, nothing is better than Comixology. It's a fantastic site.
But whether it be like Comixology or any website that actually sells the books or even just an app that has it. I mean, I want it to succeed from an independent standpoint, and I do think that they are in the driver's seat in that regard because I don't believe that Marvel and DC are. But at the same time, we've talked about that concept of people and their fear of the new to a certain degree. And so that definitely could come into that fear of the new.
Okay. Okay. What about, let's move on to another subject I had written down from last week. Then we're talking a little bit about, Comixology. No, Comixology. Jesus. Comixology. We're talking a little bit about that. And, Paul is, displeased, of course, with the quality of what their storefront is there. So let's talk a little bit about whether or not all the publishers should band together and create their own storefront instead of individually creating them. Should we see Marvel and Image and DC and even the smaller independent people, or even just the smaller independent people, should we see them just put aside, not that they're not running their own thing, but just put aside everything just to create one marketplace for people to go to and get the product in the digital world? Keith, what do you think on that?
It is Comixology already, and unfortunately, because DC's is integrated completely with Comixology, and we will likely see Marvel do that soon. If you buy something through the DC store, it is linked to your Comixology, and you can read it through both. You have bought it in both of those platforms. Marvel is expected to go that direction very shortly. What this unfortunately means is they have then narrowed the field of, this is the diamond problem from 20 years ago. We're ending up with one digital distributor that has Marvel, DC, Image, Dark Horse, and everyone else is put out in the cold because Comixology is not an open platform. No one can create a comic that you can then read on your Comixology app. You can only sell them through them and then read them there. Once we see those five or six big companies all have the Comixology storefront integrated with their own reading systems the way DC does, it is the diamond problem from 20 years.
Chris, you have a thought there.
Yeah. No, this actually ties into what Keith was saying. For the longest time, and still to this day, I've kind of wondered why Diamond hasn't adapted their model. It strikes me as an insane gesture that they haven't put out their own app of some sort, negotiated their deals to include the digital format. It's like they're just waiting to go out of business.
That's a scary thought, but I think sobering, actually, that's a good way to put it. Brett, what do you think of that?
Well, I mean, Chris, you took what I was going to say, because definitely, I mean, the number one question that I would have to ask is, why is Diamond not pushing into this market? I mean, they've already got the deals, they've already got the distribution angle worked out to a certain degree. I mean, you would think that they would be the first people that would be jumping into this, but I don't necessarily see. Again, I mean, as long as print comics are around, then Diamond is going to be around in that degree, but I mean, their business could get a lot smaller. There is no question about it. And I would think that they should be worried, definitely, about a Comixology and somebody able to take where Diamond used to have that monopoly. They can't have that monopoly now.
Okay, well, I want to talk about the next. Do you guys think that a price drop digitally, to say 99 cents per issue for everybody, would that increase the sales in the market? Or do you think that would simply cut into the profits and have about the same sales? What does everybody think about that?
Yeah, I'll go. It would definitely increase the market, but I mean, they can't do that until they either abandon the print issue. You can't sell a print issue properly, for 99 cents or profitably for 99 cents. And as long as we have paper issues, it's not a viable market. So, I mean, the question is sort of moot.
Okay. Well, I'm not even talking about whether or not the question is moot. It's a theoretical thing, though. So Keith, what do you think theoretically?
Theoretically, they would throw away 75% of their money immediately. Long term, it might get more people to move online if what they really want to do is move people from print to digital. I don't think that that's really the case. I think what they're looking for is the print audience to stay solid and then a digital audience to grow outside of that. unless someone gets
but
serious.
But they can't, can they? They can't. I mean, this doesn't seem like they can.
Without bringing back old readers that have gone, or getting new readers, no. But there's a problem with undervaluing your product, and dropping everything to 99 cents immediately would do that. Because then you would walk into the store and you would have the same thing that I have happen, and I've talked about this on the show before, where I walk into a store and I see tons and tons of books at cover price and think, well, but Amazon has them for 30% off. The real price of that item is 30% less than what's listed on the cover. It's a $10 cover. The real price of that in my head is $7 because I can get it through a different method for $7. I'm not saving money on Amazon anymore. I'm paying a premium to buy it at that store. And that's where everyone's mind goes, because you figure out what the price is. And we're seeing this in marketing, in the kind of Groupon offers, where you get your, like, you know, 50% off your restaurant price. But the next time you go, you know, last time I came, I only spent $25 and now they want 50. That product's not only worth 25 though, because I already paid it. What you'll find really quickly is the people buying the print copies then will feel like they're overpaying, and they're paying a premium to have it in print as opposed to they're getting a deal if they buy it in digital.
Have a thought on that, Pratt?
Yeah, I think that one of the problems is that what Keith said, is that even if they did shift to, like, you know, oh, well, we'll put it down in a few months, well, then all you're going to find, I think, is that people are just going to wait a few months extra. It's almost like movie watching to a certain degree was like, well, you know, I could rent it right now for a larger amount of money, or I could wait like 6 months and it's going to be on Movie Central or the Movie Network or something like that, and I can basically watch it for free. So why would I bother renting it right now when, you know, 6 months later I can watch it for free? And I think that comic books could run into that same problem. Certainly the Groupon theory absolutely applies to this, and it would be lovely to think that digital would help get those 90s readers back into the fold, because, you know, Lord knows, with the lack of comic book stores, it would be a lot easier. But the vast majority of those 90s comic book readers at that same time were not readers per se, but they were investors and speculators. And we certainly don't need to get the speculators back, and you're not going to get them back digitally.
Well, you know what? This was one I was going to bring up later, but is there any viable way that you could create collectability in a digital market? Is it totally impossible, or is it something to me? I don't think it's impossible. I think it hasn't been thought of yet, but I think anybody who puts their time and the effort and has the lateral thinking to come up with the idea, it is a possibility, and I'm not saying it should happen, but I'm not saying it shouldn't either. I don't think it's impossible, though I don't know what the idea is myself. But I think somebody out there might have the idea. Does anybody else think it is possible? And do you think it would be a good or bad thing or a moot point? Keith, what are your thoughts?
I'm not going to say impossible, because impossible is a big word. Improbable, I will say, though. What I've discovered, you know, 10 years ago, I sold off all of my rare music on eBay and made a pile of money on it. There's no such thing as a rare piece of music anymore. There's a rare hard copy, but there's not a rare song. It's available on iTunes, or it's available illegally, available on someone else's CD that you can then rip in full quality onto your computer. But there is no such thing as a rare song anymore. And no one will pay a $10 price on iTunes because they say it's rare. You paid 99 cents for a song. That's how much a song costs now. If it's on iTunes, it's 99 cents. Digital changes that, because their rarity is based on there being a physical maximum that exists and that can exist. You know, no comic produced after 1970 is ever going to be worth $1 million. Because there's only 20 copies of Action Comics number one in existence, that's why it's worth so much money. That's what rarity means, unfortunately.
Well, they do think to – they did try and create rare covers, for instance, just to give a rare – yes, the issue isn't rare, but this particular cover is rare. So therefore, this particular cover has a chance to increase in value. I do think there's a way to do it. I really do. I do think there's a big difference between digital comic books and the way to do it and music. I mean, they're not the same thing, and they don't have the same collectability anyways. Chris, what do you think?
Nude covers.
Playboy for everybody.
Well, the problem, of course, with – I mean, it's not covers. We all know it's not covers because I can get all the covers I want for free now because every sales listing has all 9 covers of Dynamite's book.
That's true.
I have those. Ta-da, they're there.
And no several of them are nude.
And some of them are nude. I can find those too.
Those are the good ones.
Yeah, there's no such thing as a rare photo anymore, that's for sure.
Okay, all right. Well, it's an interesting concept, though. I mean, somebody will take a shot at it, I'm sure. We'll see if they succeed. Now, I want to move back onto that price point a little bit here. So kind of, like I say, I think that I've always thought that there's convenience of trade paperbacks, but the price of trade paperbacks compared to the price of going and buying a novel in the bookstore or buying a magazine or anything else comparable, even buying the single issues, the convenience is what I was paying for with trade paperbacks. Because actual deal that you're getting, you're not getting a deal. You're usually getting ripped off for paying more money. I've always had difficulty with that, even though I know it doesn't have advertising. I've always thought the price points on the trade paperbacks was way, way out of line, personally.
There was a discussion of that today, Mo, that I saw, because the Wolverine and the X-Men hardcover, which is only 4 issues, 80 pages, came out at $20, $5 an issue. So higher than the original cover price and, you know, $20 for 80 pages of story. It's really an insane amount of money for how much content there is.
And that was the reason why I was late coming on. That's the reason I was late coming on to trade paperbacks because they've always done this. They have always done this. I've always known that that was not a good deal, but eventually the convenience of it won over. So what is the kind of the right price point then, do we think? Is some of it 99 cents? Some $3.99. What is the right price point you guys think then, if 99 cent is just dropping it all to that, is the wrong move as Paul seemed to think?
I think it has to be tiered pricing and I don't know exactly how you work this, because I don't know whether it becomes more logically you charge more for the ones that are going to sell better. That's pretty basic supply and demand. Digital is always weird, though, because, as I said with rarity, digital supply isn't a thing. Aside from bandwidth, you're not restricted in any way. You can sell 150 million copies of ABX number one. There is no restriction. So do you charge less the more popular it is, hoping to sell more of them? Do you charge more the more popular it is, hoping to make more money? I don't know. And
you're not sure, are you?
And there's no bargain bin. There's no bargain bin for digital. And there's no remainder bin because there are no extra copies floating around.
Chris, your thoughts?
I think 99 cents is absolutely the right price. And I think Paul was actually more affected by the coincidence or that the 99 cent thing in apps did not work, and that was his industry. And 99 cent apps, yeah, everything's free now. For a comic book, for in-app purchase, 99 cents, I believe, is the price. I think his view is colored by other stuff.
You know, Chris, and he seemed to think that he could give out a game. It'd be 99 cents and it could have, 50 levels and give you 100 hours worth of gameplay, and it's still difficult to sell. And, comic books, it's like you can read it in 15 minutes. So how can you sell more? But I'm going to give him and I hope he listens to this and kind of responds to this, because I am questioning how it is then that on the Xbox Live Marketplace, I cannot see a game that is less than really $10. And I often see games that are $20 or $30, which would cost me the same or even cheaper for a physical copy at the store, and they're charging equal amounts, and they're obviously doing price protection there, and yet the Xbox Live Marketplace is successfully selling those products, whereas at those extremely high, we're not talking 99 cents, we're talking minimum $10 to $30, they're successfully selling those things, and they're selling the add-ons, and they're selling all this, and yet the app marketplace for the iOS operating and Android operating systems and such aren't. So maybe it is simply a matter of a bunch of other factors that haven't been considered yet. Brett, what do you think on that?
I think it's expectations. You know, when the Xbox Marketplace launched, they launched immediately with the games at the price point that they wanted, whereas they didn't have competition for a price point. On the App Store and stuff like that, there is lots of competition for a price point. There's plenty of people who are willing to put out the exact same type of app and charge less than you to put that app out there in your hands. And so because of that competition, I mean, we've always seen that if you price yourself low right off the bat, then you're bound to be screwed because you can never go up. But if you price yourself high, then it's easier to go down. You know, but if you can get people hooked in at that price point, then you'll be okay. Whereas comic books, I mean, the truth is, though, is that it's really hard to justify spending the exact same amount when it does exist physically. But you are, to some degree, paying for the ease of being able to just download it, same as the Xbox.
Chris, what do you think?
This is actually sort of agreeing with Brett. The problem with apps, specifically the iOS apps for the iPad, is the marketplace is too big and competitive. We are talking Atari in the 80s competitive, and that's why we got so much junk and nobody's willing to pay for anything. If I downloaded E.T. the game for my iPad, of course I don't want to pay for it.
In fact, you wouldn't want an iPad anymore.
Yeah, it was a really terrible game. There are too many bad apps. And when you have a marketplace this large, you're going to get competition and everything is devalued. Comic books, that is not the case. That's why 99 cents is appropriate.
So Xbox and Nintendo and Sony and these places on their market systems essentially controlled the marketplace, allowing for prices that weren't ridiculous for the consumers, and yet were profitable for the publishers. Whereas iOS and Android and these places essentially allowed a free market system, which is probably really, really good for the consumers, but maybe not as good for the publishers. Is that kind of what we're getting to here, Brett?
Well. I do think it is where we're going, and I think one of the things though that I do just want to mention is that comic books were kind of placed behind the eight ball to a certain degree because people started scanning comic books the second that scanners became more, you know, or more inexpensive, you know, a little cheaper. And it wasn't easy or fun, but they did it. And so it started that market already. Whereas the truth about, you know, like downloading a video game and trying to burn it and put it onto an Xbox, there's a very hefty process to try to do that. Whereas with comic books, all I need to do is install a reader and you've created the comic book. So what Marvel and DC are doing is they're playing catch up to all the scanners that are already out there providing these comic books illegally. And so they have devalued that market where Marvel and DC don't want them to have devalued the market. And there's nothing at all that Marvel and DC can do about that right now. Whereas Xbox, basically the market isn't really that devalued from the people who have copied games and have, you know, done the hard mods or whatever. But they can afford to charge that because people still expect those kind of price points.
Yeah, and obviously those games are available out there if people wanted them. But truthfully, this is why Xbox and PS3 and these places have actually been more successful, whereas computer gaming, where it's been very difficult to stop the pirating, it's been affected. Now, what you're going to see here from Xbox and PS3, especially Xbox is the ones talking about this, you're going to see them going away more and more from those hard digital copies. And this will have a trickle-down effect into iOS and things like comic books as well. You know, when they go away from it, it's going to be one more kind of nail in the coffin, so to speak, in the idea of people holding digital these products in their home, or physical hard copies in their home. The other thing you're going to see, though, is you're going to see that they are going to make it so that people will no longer be able to purchase a game and trade it in, and it won't be able to be used on another system. Once people purchase a game, it'll be locked into your system, and that's the only system it'll play on. So you won't be able to trade games, you won't be able to share games with friends, you won't be able to sell them into used. And that is also going to have a trickle-down effect in some way, I'm sure, into the comic book market and app developer market and all this stuff as well. Because it's just the idea of a shift in how people are going to be able to get their product. Anybody have a thought on that?
Yeah, CDs tried this about 10 years ago, and it didn't work out for them. They tried to shut down used CD stores because they thought, you know, like some computer software, there should be an end-user agreement on CDs that you purchase it and you can use it for as long as you want, and then you should throw it away because we only sold it to you. It was a thing for CDs for a while, and the problem we have with digital comics is you can't loan them, and you can't resell them. So, I mean, that's one of the restrictions we have right now that we don't really have a way around.
All right, one of the things that I want to talk about a little bit more then as we move on here is, because Chris said he was kind of depressed with what came out of that show. He felt a little bit down on it from the prospect of the future. So, Chris, why don't you kind of expand on that just a little bit?
Well, I found Paul's outlook on the comic industry or comic industry as defined by Marvel and DC to be spot on. And I like the fact that Marvel publishes 800 books. I like the fact that DC has all these books as well. And I can easily see that number dropping to a few with Paul's predictions. And it's sad. I don't think either one's going out of business, but they have to change their model. And that's probably going to mean I'm not going to be able to find the Thunderbolts comic book, or there's not going to be a huge place for Iron Man and Power Fist or Doctor Strange. And I live on the outskirts of both companies. I don't read Captain America all the time. I like the Freak character, and that's who's going to lose out. I'm not going to have those marginal characters anymore. Whether they should be published right now, anyway, is kind of debatable. But I don't want to go into a comic book store and see nothing but, okay, I got a choice between the Avengers or Batman. I like those smaller, big company books. And that's what I'm going to lose. My depression was strictly from a personal choice. Aspect. I don't want Marvel and DC to get smaller, and it's going to happen.
See, that's kind of my thing is I don't think it is going to happen. I mean, I don't think they are going to get smaller. I just don't think they're going to get bigger. And kind of, I mean, one of the things that kind of he kept on saying was, what are we going to do? The business isn't going to get better, and it's not going to get this. Well, what if it doesn't get better? But what if it doesn't get worse? What if it kind of stays at the level it's at right now, which is kind of what I think will happen, largely. I mean, do you two care, do you three care if the comic book industry doesn't grow, if it just stays at the level it's at now, where there's a lot of product out there, some really, really good stuff for us, and who cares if people who don't like it don't even try it? Go ahead, Keith.
Well, I'm not Chicken Little with the sky is falling, and I'm not Pollyanna either. The reality of the comic industry is sales are not as low as they've been. There are more titles being created now than there were 20 years ago. it is not the end of the world right now. And the idea that it is all collapsing around us is just an exaggeration. I believe the comics will evolve very quickly in the same way that movies have had to, television has, music has, and books have, are now going through. And they have to find these new models. They do have to, at some point, separate digital comics and print comics. And maybe that's that there will be more of these digital first things that DC's playing with and that Marvel's playing with. Maybe there'll be more things like Infinite that can't work in a print copy. Maybe what we'll have is two streams where, you know, in the same way that you can watch your TV show and then there's a webisode that ties into it, we may see changes like that. It may not be 100% one way or the other. We may see, you know, there are characters that from Marvel and DC that can't support a monthly book because a monthly book at Marvel or DC means 5,000 plus copies minimum. We're seeing books being canceled around the 5,000-6,000 copies mark. Digital may not have that kind of restriction. Digital may have 1,000 copies because your margin's better and you're not printing anything. There's no stock you're sitting on. This may be an opportunity to have some of those characters that are marginal come out. And the more of these characters that come out, the more chance you're going to have a character like Blade, like Ghost Rider, that you can then make into a TV or movie property and make some serious cash off of it. And, you know, that's what you want is more characters that people are understanding and they're great at getting around because you can only make so many Batman and Superman movies.
You know what? People don't mind if, like people don't mind if a website, for instance, has ads on it, as long as those ads aren't intrusive. They mind pop-ups. They don't mind something in the corner that might advertise something they're interested in. And I don't think ads in digital books is a completely, as long as it's not intrusive, is completely, should be thrown out completely either. It's a possibility that could work. Chris, what do you think?
I think you guys are 100% correct in a perfect world. I just don't have enough faith in DC and faith in Marvel and DC editorial to actually accomplish something like this. Look how crappy the 52 books came out.
Look how big the sales were.
The sales were huge, but I mean, they did not do a good job at launching this thing. People were interested in the concept and that's why the sales were good, but I thought they dropped the ball on the 50.
But the sales stayed good for a long time,
and
Chris.
I'm saying they had some good books, but that's not really the point I'm getting at. And Marvel, I mean, Marvel can't launch a movie and a comic book at the same time successfully and have them tie in. They're going to screw this up. I know it. I just don't have the faith in these two companies.
Okay, but what about, like I say, so what about if the comic book industry, even if it does get smaller, it's not going away. So it's still going to be there for you, but it's not going to ever become more popular to the mass market. Do you care? I mean, I personally would like it to, but I don't really care if it doesn't, as long as I get to enjoy what I enjoy, and I know it'll always exist.
If you're not growing, you're dying.
I don't know. I thought 25 years ago that I wanted everyone to read comic books, and I couldn't make them do it. It's still the case. I think there's tons of my friends that I think would. I know they enjoy comics. They just don't buy them regularly, and I don't really understand why. But yeah, I mean, there is an element of me that is like Mo. It's not circle the wagons and disappear, but it is. If we could have a stable audience that is stable at 250,000 people, that would sustain. You know, TV shows, it would sustain, well, not TV shows, but it would sustain the kind of overhead that comics have. You don't have to necessarily always be growing, if you're keeping everyone happy and you're stable.
Yeah, I would agree with that. And you know what also, without print and the cost of stock and the cost of distribution and all this stuff through the internet, I mean, people that 10 years ago couldn't have afforded to do a comic book today can. Just like people that never could have imagined having a radio show or having a radio station all of a sudden can do a podcast, right? It's the internet does change things, so opportunity is still out there.
I think it's sad. I mean, I would like more people to be in the, or to be interested in the comic book industry. And I think the problem is that as, you know, people like us have children, although as I am the only one of us who does have a child, then, you know, like that, we're limiting our options to pass the love of comics down. But it almost becomes up to people instead of the industry to try to engender a love of comic books to continue everything going.
Yeah, I tell my dog all the time about how much I love comic books. She never reads one. You know, and if more people enjoyed comic books, it'd be good for the show. More listeners. Yay!
My cat loves comic books. They are so comfortable.
They're so comfortable. There you go.
But she hates my digital. Dog. She does not like digital comics. She likes
just digital comic books. She's aren't as nice to curl up into.
That's right.
I want to move into one last subject here. And that's kind of the idea of, why did those readers leave? Those readers who read X-Men number one? Why did they leave? Can they come back? Or will they come back? Or can they come back? Kind of. What do you two think of that? Because Brett, unfortunately, has left us from technical difficulties, and I'm not sure if we'll have him return this episode, hopefully. But if not, we'll move on. So what do you two think of that? Go ahead, Keith.
Well, I mean, you and I, Mo, ran comic stores in the 90s, so we know, particularly Death of Superman, how many new people were introduced to comics at that point. It was that and the first Batman movie were the most successful introductions of new readers that have happened in my lifetime. You know, New 52 couldn't dream of bringing in as many readers as Death of Superman did. And I think part of it was editorial. You know, at the time I ran a comic store, the four Superman titles were the four highest selling books that we sold, and then Spawn. And the problem was that it just ran down really quickly within about a year or two. I mean, I was a serious Superman fan long before Death of Superman, and even I only lasted about two more years. I think that you have to be a serious fan to wait out the boring parts and the parts that don't work, or to move on to other books. Once people started getting bored of Superman, they didn't look for other books to grab their interest. They just stopped buying.
Do you have thoughts on people, why people left, Chris? Theories?
Yeah. The industry grew stagnant for a while. The investors were no longer there. We'd sort of killed them off with gimmick covers. And really, the early 2000s were not a great time for comic book stories. It took Marvel and DC and Image a long time to realize people aren't tuning in anymore, their product was the same as it had been 5 years ago. And I think a lot of people just lost interest. As well, you had the growth of the internet and other media subtracting from your market. Then you add in the complete demise of the newsstand copies, bringing in new people, and it's a downward spiral.
You know, it's I think people don't mind if you try, if they feel like you're charging them a lot of money for something that you think is worth the money. I think they don't mind that. I think, though, nobody can deny that when the boom period was happening, and you had the foil covers and the holographic this and the multiple issues of that, that they were simply gouging people because the market was hot, and that created a level of bitterness. And I believe people left and won't come back because I think the comic book industry created a level of bitterness among that audience. And some of that was collectors, and some of that was readers, and some of that was people who were both. So a little bit, you know, and I think there's a level of bitterness and a level of distrust again. They once you break trust, it's almost impossible to build it back up again. And that comic book boom period ended up kind of being as much as money as they made. It was kind of a scorched earth. So, Chris, you had a thought there.
Yeah, no, I'm really wondering about, you know, Valiant's back, and they seem to be taking right off where they left off. The first thing they do is introduce a gimmick cover. I'm kind of wondering if it's the same people running the company.
Well, nobody does gimmick covers anymore, so I don't mind occasional one. As long as it's not, it's like, it was one thing when it was a gimmick cover on issue 300 of Spider-Man. It was another thing when it was issue 17 of War Machine.
Like, well, and the period that, you know, Fantastic Four went through a period where there was a gimmick cover, like every third or fourth issue, literally.
Yeah.
You know, during the Paul Ryan years, I think they did 3 and 6 months, and they charged more for them every time.
Yeah. And that's exactly it. I think there's a level of bitterness with people. So you guys think that they will or can they come back? Will they come back? I mean, obviously they're trying with AVX and with the ad and just in general doing the product. I think they're trying hard to get those people back. So anybody think they can or anybody think they will?
Yes. I don't think we'll ever see the numbers that we will and that we did in the 80s and 90s. But I think we have not seen the highs yet. And it may take something dramatic. It may take a Marvel relaunch before we see that.
No.
You said no. Go ahead.
Yes. No, we won't see
yes,
that.
Yes, no. Yes. No, sorry. Go ahead.
No. Before in the 90s, you went to a comic book movie and you laughed and going, I want more. Now you just have to wait till next week. There's not that demand that created the 90s boom. I don't think we're getting anyone back.
You think they've oversaturated the market in different areas and that's ruined it?
Yep.
That's an interesting theory as well. All right. Well, one person is an optimist, another one's a pessimist, and I guess that leads me to be a realistic, and as a realist, I have no idea.
I think comic books are a very, very hard thing to get back into. There's a certain core group of people that are always going to read comic books where, you know, and I'm one of those people. Like I can leave comic books for a little while, but I'm never going to fully leave comic books. Whereas I think that a lot of the 1.5 million people, I mean, besides the fact that I feel like at least half must have been speculators, but I think that with those 1.5 million, a lot of the people there, they, you know, the cost was different. Like, it's very easy to say, like, oh, well, I'm going to jump back into collecting comic books. And you know what? 2 or 3, 5 years ago, when I was somewhat out of comic books, I probably would have collected had the price point actually been like 99 cents. But with the price point actually being in the, you know, relatively expensive, I think it's hard to get back into reading comic books.
All right, and
just a quick note there. There's a lot of debate about how many people actually were ever in comics. There's never been a census. Whatever the number of the X-Men printed, I think it was like 5 million copies, actually. As a non-scientific poll, I had 6 copies. How many did you have, Brett?
I don't think I had many, but it was probably 2 or 3.
Okay, Chris?
I didn't collect the X-Men, even in the heyday.
No?
I brought the 2 or 3 with Brett. We bought them together. Okay. So.
Well, that's 9 copies between 3 of us. That's not 4. That's not too bad.
I do get what you're saying, but there's
how many stayed at the store.
I get what you're saying, but there's no question it was still more than it is today. Still more readers than today.
Absolutely.
But let's move on to We Views.
Here I come to save the day.
Let's open up with let's save the Night of Owls crossover with Court of Owls and Batman. Let's save that crossover for the main event at the end. Let's move on to The Shadow, which I really loved. Garth Ennis's Shadow. I thought this was just a tight noir story that just fit right in was I'll be back every month. Just give me a good, tight action story with a little bit of characterization and perfectly placed and paced and great dialogue and atmospheric art that suited the book perfectly. I was really high on The Shadow there. Was it Dynamite that came out through? Do anybody recall?
Yeah. Dynamite.
Dynamite. So Garth Ennis, I can't recall the artist's name, unfortunately, but this was a tremendous book. I thought tremendous might be a little high, but I really enjoyed it, and I'll be back. Keith, what do you think?
I really enjoyed this book. When I lived in Vancouver, there was a radio station that used to play the Shadow radio show Sunday nights. And
yeah.
I listened to a lot of those. And
when you and I used to work together, I used to always do the night shift. The radio station that I listened to at night played them too. That's what I would do.
Oh, nice. Yeah. And that's what this reminded me of. This felt very pulp. You know, on the outside, you might think it is quite a violent book, but those pulps were very violent. I had a good feel from this book, and it was interesting. It was exciting. It's clearly telling an arc story. I was quite engaged. I think I'm on for this book.
Chris, your thoughts?
Well, as long as we're playing Who's the Biggest Shadow Fan, I'd like it to be known that I have downloaded, illegally, let's say, the entire, run of The Shadow and listened to, including the ones that did not star Orson Welles. So I think I got you there.
You win. No, you win. But you win. I'll say this. Are those illegal when, truthfully, I think they might be public domain at this point?
I think they are.
They
may be top, but in which case you are just file sharing them. Aaron Campbell.
You're off the hook.
Aaron Campbell is the artist there, though.
Yeah. And he was well suited for this book.
But to get to the comic book, I loved it. I loved, Garth Ennis's take on The Shadow. I was a little concerned when it was announced that Garth Ennis would be taking over the book or starting the book, because Garth Ennis does some adult stuff, and I didn't think that was appropriate for The Shadow or something.
The guy who
I
would
want.
Give Playboy to a 3-year-old.
Yeah, but I mean, they're different stories. I think you can.
To be fair, he would sell Playboy to a 3-year-old. He's not giving anything away.
Anyway, go on, Chris. Sorry.
But his take was appropriate. It was violent, but so is the source material. I was a little disappointed because I'm a huge fan of the Howard Chaykin run at DC in the 90s. His take was definitely more artistic, but the more straightforward telling I find compelling. I'm definitely in, and I find it strange that no one's mentioned the Jay Lee pinup cover. Wow, just beautiful.
All right. Well, you and I read the Six Guns trade paperback that came out from Marvel. Keith didn't have a chance to get around to that one. Brett did, and you know, maybe he'll tweet out his opinion. But anyways, we'll get you to weigh in on the Six Guns.
Okay, I think we're going to differ here, but I freaking loved it. I really dig Andy Dingle's stuff on The Losers.
Diggle, not Dingle. Hey, he's not a dingleberry. He's a diggleberry.
You say it how you want. I'll say it. I like dingles.
There's no N in his name.
Yeah, whatever. I like calling him Dingle. That's what I'm going to do.
Okay.
He's a dingleberry.
I like calling you Chip. That's what I'm going to do. Go ahead, Chip.
I'll respond. But I forgot completely where I was. Oh, yes. Yes.
Randy Dingle, that's where you were.
Randy Dingle.
Big fan of that, Randy Dingle. Who did the art on this?
What the hell is this book's name?
Six Guns.
Okay.
Just start over from the beginning.
Oh my god, we gotta finish up. Let's go.
I think me and Mo are going to disagree on this book, but I loved Six Guns. I'm a huge fan of the writer, Andy Dingle. Yes. Really enjoyed the Losers. And this is more of the same. Plus, we revisit some old Western characters. Oh, I get to start again because Brett's here.
No, you can't keep going. Wait. Brett's just going to keep in on after.
Six Guns. Love the book. I think me and Mo are going to disagree on this, but I was a huge fan of the Losers, and this is more of the same. Plus, I get to revisit all my favorite Western characters that you just don't see anymore. I love the re-envisioning of them. Little concerned that I couldn't place the Black Rider as a Western character, but I'm sure he might exist. And I'm looking forward to doing the research to see if I can find a Black Rider comic book.
Brett, what'd you think of Six Guns and The Shadow?
Oh, okay. All right. Let's see now. Well, I'll start out with Six Guns because that seems to be the one that we're talking about right now. To me, it's not that I didn't like the book. I found it very adventurous and enjoyable. But it just really smacked of something that he's itching to become a movie property immediately. Like, this is the kind of thing where I'm like, oh, I'm writing this, and they're going to option it for a movie pretty much guaranteed. So it was what it was. It was fun. Would I reread it? Yeah, probably not. As far as The Shadow goes, I really enjoy that type of story. So it's pretty well written for what it is. It's not a great book, but I think it's a fun book, so.
Yeah. All right, so I'm going to talk about Six Guns, move on to that. And Six Guns, I also actually really enjoyed this book. This to me is like a late 80s action summer action film, something that I could have seen a Sylvester Stallone in the day. I thought this was a really, really fun book. I think that the last 8 pages and the climax and the way the story wraps up, I think, is a little bit anticlimactic, and the final image is kind of stupid. So that unfortunately hurt the book for me a little bit. But truth is, as a general rule, I really, really enjoyed this. Fun, good dialogue, good pace again. Really, really lots of great action. And the Black Rider character is my favorite new character in years. I also don't know if he was a Western hero before. Of course, this is in a modern telling. But that Black Rider character, his personality, and he was just a tremendous character. Awesome. So I'm going to read some more Six Guns down the road. Now we're going to move on to Night of the Owls? Night of the Owls. There you go. From Court of the Owls to Night of the Owls to whatever the Owls. And that's why we talk comics, Court of the Jowls. And next week it'll be Court of the Scowls. And the week after that it'll be Court of the Towels. Who knows? But Brett, why don't you open up and talk about Night of the Owls?
Well, let's see now. Start of the DC crossover, Batman crossover. What can I say about this book? I didn't like it. I didn't like any of the crossovers. It was just very much along that line of, like, I think maybe the story has potential to be interesting, but to me, I didn't really see the setup. I'm not interested in the payoff. Unlike Avengers versus X-Men, where I may not feel like the issues are thrilling me up to this point, I'm very interested in the payoff. In the Night of the Owls, so far, like in this stuff, I'm just not interested in the payoff. So at the end of the books, I just kind of said, yeah, whatever. you know, and they really didn't interest me. So,
Chris, what do you think?
I really like when Daredevil fights the Hand.
Oh, well put.
Yeah, no, I didn't dislike these books like Brad did. I actually enjoyed them. However, I am under the belief that no good comes of ninjas. They're like the vampire of the movies. You know, once you introduce the vampire, it ceases to be a good movie. Comic books seem to have the same problem with ninjas.
G.I. Joe, man. Yep.
Yeah.
Too many ninjas spoils the comic.
These are only sort of ninjas, though. They got other qualities.
Yeah, they have owl masks.
They're talons. I'm making some kind of vampires supposed to indicate talons. I don't even know what
they're doing. Technically dead and they can regenerate. Wait, they are vampires.
Oh, great.
Or 80s ninjas.
I am saying right now, I will enjoy this book if they introduce a good head villain. If not, I don't care. If it's just ninjas, I can't see myself enjoying it for 3 or 4 more issues. The thing I love about Batman is the villains. And if they don't introduce somebody memorable, I don't care about what's going on in this crossover.
Keith, was it you who read this first and told us what reading order these books were supposed to go in?
Yeah.
And why are they supposed to go in this order? Can you kind of explain that? Because I'm going to actually give my review. Yeah, no, all I'm going to tell you, okay, technically what you gave us was the right order. But as far as understanding the story, that middle part sure told me what was going on. Whereas the first part, Batman #8, who are the Court of Owls? What are their powers? Why are they attacking Batman? What is this that they've been, apparently he's mad because he didn't have control over the city the whole time? I don't understand any of that. As a self-contained story, that's an entertaining story. And I'm sure people who've been reading Batman really enjoyed it. As a jump on point for a crossover, it sucked balls. It was like the worst thing ever. One of the worst I've ever read jump on points. Just terrible. Nightwing was enjoyable, because I kind of was starting to understand what was going on there, and it was pretty good. It was all right. So, I mean, I won't be back for any night. Actually, tell you the truth, we'll probably have to read week 2 of this to see where it's going. But if there wasn't, this is the first 52 I've read since. 52 outside of DC's The Ray would have been the closest thing. And, of course, it doesn't have me coming back, especially after that Batman. Yeah, it was enjoyable, but what was going on? Somebody tell me something. Give me a paragraph at the beginning. Something. Keith, what do you think?
Chris wanted to jump in there before I do mine.
Yeah, I just wanted to jump in and tell our listeners that we read Batman #8 and Nightwing #8 as well as the free preview. That is what we're reviewing.
Might as well toss that in now. Well, it's interesting hearing the points of view from the three of you that aren't following Batman. I will say, just to most points, it actually isn't supposed to be a jump on point. The concept of this event is that if you are reading one of the books regularly, you should continue following it and have fun. If you're not reading one of them, none of the stories should be required reading. So that if you're a Nightwing reader, you don't have to buy the other parts of the story. You just continue reading Nightwing. It's part of the new concept of how to do a crossover.
And it sucks. It still sucks because no matter what, if you're picking up Batman #8, if you don't know what's going on, you failed as a narrative. If everybody should be able to pick up that story and at least know what's going on. I enjoyed it, but I didn't know what was going on. You should be able to do both. Somehow, some way, get it across.
I disagree. It's a breath of fresh air compared to the way Marvel freaking does it. I have no idea what's going on.
Oh, Marvel makes it so easy for me. I appreciate it. Well, they're crossover crazy, but at least that something. Keith, go ahead.
I loved these books. I thought they were awesome.
Because you've been reading.
Because I've been reading it.
Yeah, exactly.
And it's, so it isn't an old-fashioned crossover. It isn't an event like you've seen before that stands all on its own. It's not meant to. It is the culmination of everything that Snyder's been doing, since the relaunch. He has been telling one story, and it is about the Court of Owls. And to a greater extent, it's building on what, he and Higgins had done in Gates of Gotham, which was setting up the secret history of Gotham, which I'd highly recommend. It's out in trade paperback now. This is the culmination of a long story. It isn't a self-contained thing, which means it also isn't disposable the way a lot of events are, where there's no lead-up and there's no repercussions. This has both. I really liked it. The way they're structuring this seems to be that all of the crossovers will take place the same night. That is literally the night of the Owls. And the free preview, which it's only about an 8-page story, so I don't think I'm not too worried about spoiling something that is free. But that's the point at which all of the other Bat family are told to come help. And
now you spoiled it.
Well, I just said I was going to. and it's a free preview, so get off your butt and go read it. Yeah, I haven't already. But it does set up how the other ones tie in. So I think that, from that perspective, yeah, maybe I should have recommended reading that one first. I mean, story-wise, it does take place second. Perhaps it would have been more helpful to you because it is more of an introductory for the people who are going to be getting part six or part eight of the storyline on its own. And it gives the reason why they'll be leaping into action in their number 9 issues, starting in 2 weeks.
Okay. Let's go out with our plugs and final thoughts. Brett, go ahead.
All right. Well, let's see now. To get rid of the business first, Brett, B-R-E-T-T _ WeTalk on Twitter. Brett at WeTalkPodcast.com. Of course, WeTalk Music is finally launched with its interview series. We started off with a silly little interview with the Cancer Bats. And Aaron V. from Kill Panda Kill and I sat down and gave our thoughts on it. We're going to be doing, I believe, Lacuna Coil next. And we've got a whole bunch of bands waiting to come through and get put on the website. So there's lots of music stuff coming up on WeTalk.
Chris, what do you think? What's going on, man?
The first blog for WeTalk Movies should be up by the time this podcast hits the interweb. I'm Chris at WeTalkPodcast.com, Chris_ WeTalk on Twitter. Everybody needs Playboys for everybody.
If they're free. Keith, what do you think? What's going on, man?
Well, you can email me, Keith@WeTalkPodcast.com. I would love to receive fan mail. My last couple of fan letters to our pals at Whipping Boys got read on their podcast, which was very great, and I was walking along listening to the podcast, laughing my head off at them and responding to my email for quite a lengthy period of their episode. I feel like I guest hosted. And you can follow me on Twitter, CubReporterK, and after about a week and a half or 2 weeks off from reviewing for Comicosity, I will be back doing reviews. The first one will be the prelude to Night of the Owls. And I am also getting back into reading some comics, and on the recommendation of a couple of pals on Twitter, I gave Red Hood and the Outlaws a second try, and after the first couple of issues that were a little rough, I have quite gotten into it, and I'm interested to see how that fits into the Night of the Owls crossover next month.
All right, I'm Mo, at WeTalkPodcast.com or Mo_WeTalk on Twitter. Everybody, hey, if you appreciate what we do, all we ask is you tweet it out or go ahead and hit that tweet button on our pages or like us on Facebook. That would be awesome. And say Brett's got his stuff up. You see probably 3 wrestling blogs this week. Chris's movie blog. I got another blog coming up. More We Talk Wrestling. Lots of stuff going on. We're probably not going to have a We Talk Comics next week, just so everybody knows, because what we're going to be doing is we're going to be gearing up for the Calgary Comic and Entertainment Expo. We have received our media passes for the Expo, and we will be able to gather up some interviews with some creators in the comic book world, as well as hopefully some other famous people, and give you guys some really cool stuff coming forward. So because of that, there will be no We Talk Comics next week, but we have set up a we're going to keep it as a surprise, but we have set up a former editor-in-chief of a publisher that was quite popular in the 90s, and that's also going to be an online thing, and we're going to be talking to this individual, and it's going to kick ass. So that's just a little tease coming up. So other than that, we're going to go OUT now with The Touched by Stan Bush.
You got the touch. You got the power.
You got the power!